Hello, and welcome to the Miko Bits Show, and I'm your host, Miko Bits. Today, we have Megan Nabb, who is founder and CEO of Franklin. So, Franklin is a payroll product, it is a financial product, and an exciting product. So we're going to talk about the future of that space. We're going to talk about Franklin, the product, Web3 payroll. So lots of exciting topics for today. So just wanted to welcome Megan to the show. So welcome to the Miko Bits Show.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to chat.
Yeah, terrific. So let's open with the classic question of what problem does Franklin solve?
Sure. So as you mentioned, Franklin is a payroll product. We are unique because we can process payroll in USD. We can also process it in crypto, and we can enable our customers to use a mix of both or one or the other. I started Franklin about a year and a half ago with my two other co-founders because I had been running the back office of a Web3 consulting firm, and we had grown the staff from around 12 to up to 60. We had grown revenue, over 10x, and it became very unwieldy to manage a multi-currency balance sheet. And one of the most difficult things about that process is paying your team. So we had people in the United States who were employees of our entity. We're a US company. We had contractors all around the world. We wanted to be able to pay them in a mix of the currencies on our balance sheet. And there really just was no tool for us to be able to do that and for us to be able to do it in a compliant manner. And so that was the sort of genesis for why we decided to start Franklin. We knew it was an issue that other companies in the Web3 space were having. So we're super excited to be in market now.
That's terrific. I really do love a founder story that kind of follows the pattern of sort of feel the pain, fix the pain, right? So that's yes. A really terrific thing. You know, obviously, I think as you mentioned, Megan, that you were an acting CFO. So I think the extent to which you have a deep understanding of the pains of being a CFO, especially in the Web3 era, is, you know, I think very good. And it makes you a very astute kind of product person, you know, because you're really trying to solve the pain that you yourself felt. So just as a quick caveat to the audience, like, you know, my fund, Gumi Cryptos Capital, is invested in Franklin Payroll. As I usually say, you know, we invested because we're excited about it. So we're excited to bring you this content. But of course, don't construe any of this as investment advice and, you know, do your own research. So with respect to the kind of next questions around Franklin, so tell me a little bit about this idea of hybrid payroll, right? Which is, you know, how do you see the use of both fiat payment and Web3 payment? And are you seeing kind of customers doing both?
Yeah, definitely. I think that it definitely depends on the type of company. And one of the initial sort of drivers for me and my co-founders to start this was this sort of bad taste in our mouth that Web3 companies aren't using Web3 technologies to operate their businesses. And that's another reason why we thought this is a great idea and a great product to bring to market, to be able to take the technology that we're building in this like open source Web3 world and be able to use things like stablecoins or other tokens to, you know, pay your team and also to be able to meet the requirements of whatever jurisdiction that you're in. So that's what I would say there.
So what is your sort of ideal customer profile today, right? So, you know, if I were to try to understand the types of folks that would be beautifully situated to benefit from your product, like how would you describe them?
Yeah, I think that there's a wide range. There are obviously the sort of like very bread and butter Web3 companies that are already operating natively on chain that are looking for a solution that's compliant. So they already have stable coins on their balance sheet, right? They already have a team of people that want to be paid in these kinds of currencies. Those are largely like Web3 startups, Web3 consulting firms, or this sort of Web3 adjacent type business that we've encountered, which is they're sort of like a normal Web2 company selling a software service, but they're accepting some of their payments in stablecoins and they want to be able to put that to use. So there's this one category that we've largely been working with of, you know, the Web3 native companies that really understand like the value proposition off the bat. There's this other profile of company that is maybe Web3 curious, I would say, where they're looking at creating interesting compensation packages for their workers. And they think that crypto could be an interesting type of employee benefit to be able to offer as part of a larger compensation package. You know, we started at the very beginning of the most recent bear market cycle. But interestingly, we see across tech and fintech in general, in the Western world, as well as globally, younger workers, so the sort of like earlier end of the millennial generation and Gen Z, have more of an appetite to be paid this way. And so that's the sort of like burgeoning market that we're really excited about getting into and being able to serve as well.
Yeah, that's definitely very exciting. Obviously, there are issues with traditional banking, and I think banks these days are a little bit sort of unstable, right? So I think definitely trust in banking is sort of at a multi-decade low, so especially among the younger generation. So I think these are really kind of exciting opportunities. I guess one of the questions that sort of arises in that context is really thinking about how you see compensation mix, right? So I'm curious, kind of like in terms of the average customers that you have, kind of how do you see people mixing? Like, is it really that there are employees that are kind of token only, stablecoin only, cash only, or are there individuals being paid in a mix? Or how do you see, you know, and obviously that depends on the profile of the customers that you describe, right? These two segments.
Yeah, definitely. And just to like touch on a point you made earlier, I think that so many of us in the United States, at least watching these regional banks kind of go belly up, have had a real education in a lot of things that, you know, people who are passionate about Web3 have been talking about for a long time. And so, you know, one example in our industry is Rippling, which is a traditional Web2 payroll processor, actually wasn't able to meet some of the payroll deadlines because of on behalf of their customers because of the banking crisis. And so that's like a very interesting scenario for us to try and talk about the value proposition of being able to have a more flexible payroll system where you can do USD. Obviously, you need to have a pretty solid infrastructure with multiple banking partners, which we do, to ensure that that Rippling problem never happens. But then you can also have cryptocurrencies that can settle instantly. That's one thought there. With regards to how we have seen customers and workers that are getting paid on our platform, like that spectrum of preferences, I think that there is a large community of specifically developers in Web3 that are outside of the United States that are working for US-based crypto companies. And those people really want exposure to the US dollar. You know, we have a number of companies that have Argentinian developers, right? These are people that are suffering through a hyperinflated currency. There are a lot of macroeconomic issues. Paying them in stablecoins is actually a real competitive advantage for those companies to be able to offer that. But obviously, you don't want to be sending one transaction at a time. You don't want to have to be manually doing all this paperwork, storing wallet addresses on your own, right? We need a better solution for that. So that's maybe one side that's like the value proposition of that is very clear. It's not just people in Argentina. There are plenty of other jurisdictions around that want, you know, who have workers that want exposure to the US dollar. And, you know, stable coins have been around for a while. Circle, like maybe one of the oldest Web3 companies, right? But we still have a lot of work to do, I think, to be able to make stable coins more useful. And this is one way that I think we do that. There is another profile, I would say, of a more hybrid mix, and this is more of our sort of core customer, where you have workers based in the US. They're pretty happy getting a USD paycheck, but they want ETH, you know, as part of a quarterly bonus. Or the company wants to be able to distribute their own native token to their workers in like one unified way. The way that Web3 financial operators do this right now, if they're not using Franklin, is you have a Web2 payroll service. You're kind of doing some complicated things around the software to try and generate like a net payout, right, number. and then you're manually processing the crypto. This is not a good solution. We should be able to automate these tools and things like that. So that's another profile. There is also, you know, I think a misunderstanding from some companies who say they run crypto payroll about like what that really means. We really care. You know, I'm an accountant by trade. I really care about making sure that what we're doing is in line with the rules of the jurisdiction that we're operating in. And so, you know, the United States is interesting. Each state is like its own mini country. It has its own set of employment law. It has its own set of tax rates, right? Which these are not open source data points. And so what we do is we look at each state. We look at the requirements. There are a couple of states that openly say you can't be paid in crypto at all for the W-2 portion of your salary. So we'll make sure that if you have you're employing people in that state, that you know you're off to a good start and you're not doing anything that would violate the law, and also you know that your workers are being paid according to how they're supposed to be paid.
That's pretty amazing. So this raises a bunch of super interesting topics, right? I think obviously one of the really astounding topics is really related to the kind of optimal countries, right? Because, you know, in a sense, like hyperinflation definitely has this tremendous and potent effect on workers, right? So to me, like one of the amazing things that I think has been, you know, part of the development of this idea is that when you think about the stability of a national currency, there's definitely this amazing impact of this sort of social contract, right? Mm-hmm. So as you start to see hyperinflation, you know, the idea becomes that people ought to be able to exchange their labor for some kind of value, right? But obviously, if the value that they're exchanging it for is kind of being inflated away, like that just feels really dysfunctional, right? So that's a beautiful use case. And I think it's one where stable assets can really perform like a powerful function. I think the other one that I thought was a really beautiful use case that you also described is kind of related to how existential payroll is, right? So one of the things that we really respected a lot and enjoyed a lot about kind of working with you is that as a CFO, I think you have a unique appreciation for how existential payroll is, in the sense that like if your company misses payroll for whatever reason, if your bank goes under, it doesn't matter what the reason is actually. Like at some level, like what people care about is that they're, you know, they can continue to survive, right? Like so to me, like the treatment of payroll as sort of this the most existential and important enterprise application is probably sort of like, you know, it's almost definitional. So I really appreciate that aspect of it. I guess on a final note, one of the things that pops up for me is like DAOs, right? So like it feels like DAOs are almost, you know, most DAOs are almost entirely crypto-based, right? So in a sense, most DAOs aren't like, oh, here's my fiat bank account, right? So I guess, you know, how are you seeing the DAO space and are you kind of getting involved in that? Because obviously there's also legal DAOs and DAOs have legal status, you know, with LLCs or with Wyoming or with whatever else is going on.
Yes, this is like a nerdy side passion of mine. I've been excited about DAOs for years. I gave a couple of talks on the economics of DAO balance sheets back in the day. And I think it's a very interesting kind of customer. I had an interesting conversation actually with Mark Lurie, who runs Shipyard, which they build Dexus and the Cosmos ecosystem. And yep. We were kind of debating a little bit, you know, Franklin views itself as this kind of like bridging mechanism between Web 2 and Web 3, right? To be able to help companies in Web 2 get exposure to crypto and vice versa, have Web3 be able to use their native assets compliantly. But I do think that DAOs and some other more kind of like hardcore crypto native companies, like it's an economy of its own, you know, and the currency of that economy is in crypto, right? And so we should be able to use it effectively. And so we work with DAOs. We have a couple like requirements about the kinds of DAOs that we work with. So you have to have a legal entity. We'll only work with legal DAOs. But, you know, that's not to say that that's the only way to run a DAO. That's just the type of DAO that we'll work with. And it's interesting, too, because there's a lot of experimentation with how do you sort of like manage the HR side of a DAO, right? Or how does the DAO itself manage that, right? With its contributors, like how do you classify the payments to those contributors, things like that. So those are all really exciting issues that, we're digging into with our customers.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. I guess for me, I'm super curious about sort of how do you see the future of DAO employment, right? Because obviously, you know, if I reason about DAOs, right, it's sort of this nouveau organization, and it has potentially the capacity for much wider distribution of incentives, right? So it's not necessarily like the classical model of employment, right? So it's much more freewheeling. Yeah. But at the same time, like your product is kind of a compliance product, right? So at some level.
Yeah.
So I'm curious kind of like, do you see, what's the future of this? How big do DAOs get? How important are DAOs? Like what's the future of DAOs?
I think there are a couple different like parallel features that we can see, some of which are already existing and will continue to grow, and some I think of which, you know, are in the process of development. I think at one end of the spectrum, there is this sort of, you know, DAOs, the way from a money perspective, like from a balance sheet perspective, the way that many DAOs are structured, right, is anytime you interact, right, you become essentially part of the cap table of that DAO. And so they become very wide. With like lots of different contributors, there's, you know, contributors can be working with multiple DAOs, right? And that really lends itself to more of like a freelancer type model where you have, you know, people who specialize in whatever sort of DAO service they provide. For me, I've worked for DAOs in the past and I did their accounting on chain, which was super fun. So I think that's one way where, you know, you don't necessarily have like a 9-to-5 job with one organization, like, you know, generations before us have. You have multiple gigs and you get paid in different ways according to whatever that DAO ecosystem looks like. I think there's this other side of DAOs that, you know, when we think of a DAO, we think of an organization. I think that there's a sort of medium term ground where we can make normal traditional corporations a little bit more democratic using DAO tooling. So rather than having this, you know, top-down hierarchy, like I'm the CEO, you're the VP of finance, whatever, you know, you can use DAO voting, you can use DAO incentivization, things like that for things like normal operational processes, right? You could use it to think about managing your cap table. You know, it can be used as a compensation tool, it can be used as a budgeting tool, it can be used as surveys. You know, there are a lot of different, like maybe like smaller use cases that can exist on-chain using a DAO framework. And so that's kind of interesting. And it's stuff that we're thinking about ourselves, like how do we involve some DAO elements in the running of our own business without wanting to go full hog, being a total DAO, completely decentralized?
So I would like to kind of paint a bigger future vision, right? A dreamy vision. This is not necessarily just Franklin and just DAOs, but really for the planet at large, right? Which is one of the things that humans have been working on for many decades is actually controlled nuclear fusion and abundant clean energy, right? So the idea becomes like in a future state where we have abundant clean energy, it really changes a lot of the economics, because I believe that the standard corporation with centralization, command and control is very much kind of focused on scarcity and survival, right? Whereas the thing that's very interesting is that there are opportunities for other values to arise in an atmosphere where there's abundance, right? So in a world where there's energy abundance, right? The thing that can happen, so for example, cooperatives have existed for many years, right? So like, you know, and some of these are structured as nonprofits, but like in general, they're, you know, even, you know, the outdoor equipment store REI is a cooperative, right? So like there's definitely fairly large kind of semi-corporate cooperatives that are basically collectives of people that are coordinating in order to distribute, you know, the proceeds of collective action or to kind of like, you know, so if you are a member of REI, you get like a rebate, right? So it's a nonprofit and all the members are basically getting the profit back as sort of a payout, right? So I guess what I'm really suggesting is that, you know, if the world is able to move into a phase of things like energy and resource abundance, you know, we should see organizations that are not kind of solely designed around scarcity and survival, right? And therefore not solely around command and control, right? Because command and control has proven to be a fairly effective paradigm for scarcity and survival. Right. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so if you paint a much longer view, right, if there is an opportunity for the species to enter into more of an abundant life cycle, you know, and obviously this is a very, very hopeful scenario. But I think I just wanted to kind of like say that these aren't off the table scenarios, right? Obviously, it might take a while. You know, we don't. I think fusion energy has always been something like 10 years away or 20 years away, right? So like, you know, it's unclear if we're going to get something like this to happen. But, you know, I just wanted to kind of like talk about these kind of broader visions for what might happen, right? So, you know, obviously, you know, the beautiful thing that I think is exciting about Franklin is that like, until then, there's a ton of like today use cases, you know, like things like Argentina, you know, there's, you know, things like existing legal DAOs, you know, and there's people and the younger generation who, and even the idea of securing payroll against these kinds of like, you know, bank problems. Yeah. So, you know, how do you look at this kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's super interesting to like put on your futurist sort of hat. I can't say that I know a lot about nuclear fusion, but I think that one like big thing that I think about, at least like politically in the United States, is this notion of universal basic income. And so we, you know, especially the past couple months, just seeing the sort of leaps and bounds that AI has moved into our lives. You know, a couple examples just from ourselves operating a business. You know, our development team uses Copilot with GitHub. That really speeds up our development cycles.
That's great.
We use AI-based assist tools in Notion that really helps us with writing requirements. We can use this for business development, right? There are a lot of great tools there. And the way that we operate our business and my daily job has changed quite a bit. And I think when we look at how that ripple effect will kind of, you know, occur in many other areas of industry, and just transforming people's daily lives. Like, it seems clear to me that universal basic income needs to become more of a reality. That's tough from a policy level, and we can talk about that a lot. I think that we've experimented with it a little bit, just with the sort of like checks that the U.S. government sent out to people during the pandemic, when we were going through this wild economic moment. You know, a lot of those checks that went out to you know, your average sort of American citizen were actually processed through payroll providers, right? There are like two or three massive payroll providers that process, you know, something like tens of billions of dollars every month, right? These systems are extremely antiquated, right? And they hold on to money for so long, right? It costs money to be able to operate that. And there's a medium term step that we're taking of, we just need to improve payroll technology. And we can do that in a number of different ways. And we can use it in Web3. And then there's this other sort of thing of, you know, as our economy changes, and as money moves around between people, between employers differently, between the government and workers, between the government and companies, right, we need systems that are faster, they're more accurate, and then have the capability to actually move money like at a large scale. You know, there are so many instances of fraud that occur, right? Of banks not properly sending out paper checks to people. You know, what are you supposed to, you can't go to, everything was closed. You couldn't go to a bank to cash your check, right? For some of these little credit unions, they don't have like the mobile app. So, you know, it's funny to think about all these like little pieces and things, but it has like a real impact on people's lives. And I think speed up 10 years, it's not that far into the future. Like, we're going to be there, and we need the people building these rails in the meantime. So yeah, it's super interesting. Yes. There's so many different futures, right, to think about.
Yeah, and I do believe this, right? Which is, you know, I think it's super. The thing that I think is most amazing is to talk about sort of really today and kind of near term, right? So obviously today there's compliance, right? And there's all these really kind of burning use cases for people, right? And to me, the thing that's great becomes like, obviously we're talking about sort of things like the further future, right? But when you start to think about AI, AI is already impacting employment and it's going to get much more significant, right? So, you know, the other day, Jason Calacanis was tweeting that about a third of tech jobs will be eliminated through more efficient use of AI, right? So, like, it definitely will have a huge and profound social impact, right? So, these are really interesting. Obviously, there's new emerging trends around things like pseudonymous employment, right? So, there's people who are working, but that the employers don't actually have, like, maybe specific knowledge of the exact, you know, identity of the worker. You know, there may be mechanisms through which people can, you know, when you look at things like gig workers, like that's already borderline pseudonymous in the sense that, like, you know, if you go into Fiverr, like, does it really matter if your worker's name is, you know, Sally or Bob or, you know, it kind of doesn't, right? And so, you know, if you're on Fiverr, you could be Sally and you could say that your name is Bob. Right. And like maybe you want to do that because it might result in you getting more gigs. Right. So, like, definitely there's changes coming to the world of employment, you know. So that's definitely big and impactful. I would say that the looking at the midterm, I think that's a pretty exciting thing. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, since your product, you know, has this ability to protect organizations' compliance, is what about the idea of nationally regulated stablecoins? So how do you see, because I feel like that's not the far future. I feel like there are definitely countries, things like MiCA regulation in Europe, where we're getting within striking range of specific countries just declaring bank and government-backed stablecoins. So I'm curious what your views are.
Yeah, I think that that is the eventuality, right? How quickly it happens, you know, we'll see. The beautiful thing is this, if it's on a public blockchain, right, it's easy for us to interact with. I think that for, you know, in the United States, what if I were to bring out my crystal ball and guess, you know, I think that it would be used more for like interbank settlement and settlement with like the Fed to start. I think that the retail use case is would still be very far away. And I think it should still be far away because we're not there on the privacy tech yet. And so, you know, when we were starting Franklin, what we really wanted to do, like our initial first idea was like, how do you have a totally private payroll? You know, and we talked to every privacy protocol building in the Ethereum ecosystem, and the development tools are just not there yet. I think we'll get there, and that's some of the tech that I'm most excited about in Web3. And there's some, you know, hustle, right, that has to happen. We need these tools to be there. We want the government or the Federal Reserve or, you know, whatever institution is the issuer to be able to leverage those tools so that we can protect retail privacy. You know, some less of an issue, right, for interbank settlement. So that's what I would say there. I think that the story of Franklin is tied to the story of the evolution and continued adoption of stablecoins, and you know, we're super excited about that, whoever brings them about.
Yes, I have an upcoming episode with Elena, who is the CEO of Ironfish, which is a privacy infrastructure, and it's quite exciting and very. She's extremely eloquent and very kind of smart and great at explaining a lot of the emerging privacy tech. So I think the audience will enjoy that. But I think from, you know, the perspective that I think is really interesting is that negotiation, right? Because ultimately, for example, there are compliance initiatives that are fairly non-negotiable, like KYC AML, right? And so obviously governments have a very strong interest, right? And when you really think about the right to privacy as defined and enshrined by the United States Constitution, right, it's really protective of, it's a little bit like speech, right? In the sense that there's constitutionally protected speech, but there's also constitutionally protected privacy, right? Which is really has to do with unreasonable search and seizure, right? So the thing that's amazing is that reasonable search and seizure is actually enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, which is not something that the privacy advocates necessarily focus on or espouse, right? So, you know, to me, the things, use cases you're describing, I think make a ton of sense. Because in the history, one of the crazy, so Steve Jobs is widely touted in Silicon Valley. And one of the insane things Steve did one day is he actually went to his hallway outside his office and he tacked a sheet of paper that was a spreadsheet of every single person's salary and their name. And the result was just terrible. Like, it was just atrocious. Like, everybody, it just turned into this giant war, and like everyone was kind of filled with anger, right? And it definitely was like, it was not a social experiment that he repeated, right? Like,
but
in a sense, he's that kind of a innovator, right? He's just someone who's like, I don't have a lot of inhibitory neurons in my brain, so I'm just gonna like do things, you know, and see how people react, right? But like, I think the object lesson of that exercise was that doesn't make sense. Like, you know, people want privacy around certain things, and that's a very certain thing that people want privacy around. You know, that not just the individuals, but the organization also wants privacy around that. Like, everybody wants privacy around that. So
for sure.
I think that's very important as far as the functioning of society.
Yeah, it's hilarious. Like, as you know, we at Franklin, our salaries are transparent to each other. And that's just something that we started off with. We have the benefit of a small team.
Impressive.
You know what I mean? But I think, and like lots of DAOs, right? You can see pretty much everything on chain. But for the average worker, right, for the average company, that's not something that's in vogue. And it's not something that we should push as something that, you know, should be a good new policy to publish everyone's salaries. I do think that there's like a thing here that's interesting, which is like making wages more public, which, you know, New York State, which is my home state, you know, has said you have to publish salary ranges on job descriptions. Right. There's obviously the Lilly Ledbetter Act that was, you know, I think the first act that Obama signed back in, you know, whenever.
You have to publish averages.
You have to. So on job descriptions for in New York State, you have to publish the salary range that you would pay. So that's interesting. You know, a lot of employers are out there posting $0 to $200K. Right. Which is not in the spirit of the law, but it technically checks the box to meet the requirement. Right. And you know, wage transparency, I think, is important when we think about equality between genders and
wide
different racial groups
ranges
and things like that. Yeah, right. So, but for the most part, right, these are things that need to be kept private for other reasons too, right? There are some protected classes, right, of workers in the United States where that information should not be public, just due to certain like employment standards. So you know, there's a long way to go.
Yeah, agree. And like, you know, I think when I kind of reason about this at the kind of super macro level, like my ethos that's visible on Miko.com website is that open source financial infrastructure will make the world more consensual, fair, just, inclusive, transparent, and innovative, right? So, you know, if you kind of go back to that as kind of a battle cry, right, obviously the idea of, you know, more inclusion and more fairness kind of ties back to some of the principles that you're describing, right? So it's very complex ultimately, right? Because it also kind of ties back to more complex use cases for privacy technology, right? So for example, one of the use cases that I was described to yesterday by a very astute PhD from Cornell blockchain is he was basically describing that if a company is continuously publishing average salary, then the thing that's really interesting is that you can actually compute a specific person's salary when they leave, right? Because
simple math, right?
You know, the number of people. Yeah, it's super simple math, right? So the thing that's really amazing is kind of like these incredible scenarios where you can actually break privacy just through inference, right? So the thing that becomes so interesting is that there are actually now emerging technologies that do things like generate random number sets and they generate things like random employees that have fake names, you know, and so they so it creates this kind of cloud of obfuscation that's used to sort of like, so it's amazing stuff, right? So all of this stuff is emerging now under the banner of like zero knowledge proofs, you know, but I do think that we definitely have a ways to go before that stuff becomes incredibly practical. But I'd love to kind of harken back to the conversation around regulated stablecoins, right? Because you were talking about kind of like things like permissioned and private chains like CDBC, central bank digital currencies. But there may actually be a very kind of antithetical approach that takes place, you know, in kind of countries where they do have hyperinflation. You know, Brazil's president actually proposed to Latin American countries that they create an economic union like the euro, right? So there could be a Latin American currency. It's possible that that could be, you know, implemented on a public chain. So I'm really curious about sort of like, because the thing that's so exciting about something like what you're doing is that it really only takes like a modest sized country, and all of a sudden you could be, you know, doing pretty substantial business there.
I mean, you know, I think that there's the precedent for this around the world, right? So like there are local currencies, right, that are used in areas, sub-Saharan Africa, parts of Eastern Asia, where you know, just geographically, these communities are not connected to the wider economy in their country, right? And so there's local currencies. And this is not like an old antiquated thing. This is like a solution that really works for these communities. You know, in the United States, we have script currencies, right? Like there's been talk in Congress, like, is crypto a script currency? Could it be? You know, I think that it's totally possible. Like you can have a public-private hybrid situation. You know, the really like kind of more like maybe like philosophical point is like, what is the value of a dollar? Should we be pegging the value of our crypto economy to you know, a US dollar or any sort of like national currency, right? We think about, they just, I think the Senate in the United States just passed the debt limit bill today, right? Like the US dollar could have tanked and then we'd be—
Oh, that's a relief.
A different, yeah, right? Like, we just pushed it down the way for another 2 years for another big fight about it, you know, that goes down to the wire. But yeah, I think that this sort of like mix of options like is the most likely outcome. Just like, you know, I don't think we'll have one blockchain to rule them all, right? In the future is probably multi-chain
for sure,
and interoperable.
For sure. And I think to me that is kind of the exciting future, right? Because ultimately when we think about freedom at the largest macro level, like freedom is really about having options, right?
Right.
And not being trapped, right? So in a sense, like there may be, like as you describe, you know, like countries that have hyperinflation, they really need something. Like they, you know, they, and pegging something to the dollar is just part of a much larger movement, right? Which is the much larger movement is kind of this idea of real world assets, right? So if you think about real world assets, like they're backed by things. Now, obviously to me, if you look at Bitcoin, like the US dollar, is backed by several things. Ultimately, belief, right? But it's also backed by energy. Right. So if you look at things like the petrodollar as the demand, the dollar is the demand currency for petroleum, right? Electricity is the backer of Bitcoin, right? So it's a very direct conversion, right? And then once you have belief, then you can have things like the exchange of labor for Bitcoin. You can have the exchange, you know, so belief obviously is kind of like foundational. But I do think that like, you know, it's fascinating to kind of contemplate real world assets, right? So I think, you know, obviously there's huge regulatory issues around that, right? Because, you know, otherwise you just get this kind of Brooklyn Bridge coin where I can sell you the Brooklyn Bridge, you know, and it's a really cheap, only $1 million for the whole Brooklyn Bridge. You know, think about what you could do with that. You know?
Right.
And of course I don't own the bridge. So, you know, it's a scam, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, so to me, like obviously regulations need to be improved, but I think to me, the US dollar coin, whichever version that you want is just another real world asset. Backing.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, one project that I'm watching that I think is super exciting just because, so I used to work at an equities broker. That's where I met my co-founders. You know, buying stocks in the United States is this extremely convoluted process when you pop the hood under and see how money and equity moves between all the different levels of brokers. You know, and we don't actually like own our stock, right? We own a claim to a claim to a claim to a claim on a stock. And it takes, you know, 2-3 days to go through the financial system for it to actually end up in your like ledger name at DTCC. DTCC yep. has started experimenting with blockchains to be able to settle stocks faster and cut out all of this massive infrastructure. And I think that there are so many use cases like that. And, you know, it's going to be an exciting
That's
financial system in the next
10 years. Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation.
Yeah. So yeah.
Just for the audience's sake. So, you know, one of the things I want to shout out too is Ondo Finance, mm-hmm. right? Which is this basically a way for on-chain people to collect APY from holdings like U.S. money markets, U.S. treasuries, you know, and kind of additional potentially slightly higher risk, higher yielding assets, right? But generally speaking, assets that are kind of fairly stable. You know, I had this funny conversation with Arthur Hayes where I asked him what the asymmetric trade was. And he, you know, obviously, I was obviously thinking about some kind of crazy degen crypto scheme that he would describe, you know, like a Pepe coin or something.
Sure.
And, you know, he said in a classic fashion, he said U.S. treasuries, right? So like that's a, you know, obviously we're in a fascinating bear market and a really fascinating macro, right? But like, you know, that strikes me as kind of real world assets again, right? So, you know, it's fascinating to see. So, you know, I feel like the future in the short term is absolutely kind of dealing with these problems like unstable banks, dealing with hyperinflation, dealing with DAOs, you know. But I think in the midterm, you know, dealing with nationally and government and bank regulated stable coins gets pretty exciting. And
yeah.
I think obviously in the long term, the fundamental transformation of work.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But I think to your point, if you talk to any financial operator in Web3 right now, they're pulling their hair out. Like, what could I do, you know, to make my life a little bit easier? So, yeah.
Yeah, it's extremely painful and difficult. So I guess one of the things I'd love to understand is kind of like, what are some neat features of Franklin as a product today? And then, you know, after we talk about today, I'd love to also talk about kind of roadmap things, but I'd love to talk about like what's available today. You know, what are the differentiating and cool features that you want to highlight?
Yeah, for sure. I think that one thing that's really interesting, we can have a whole other podcast episode about that, is how intimately payroll is tied to health benefits in the United States. There's really a public solution, right? Most healthcare is privatized and it's run through, like logistically, operationally, it's run through payroll providers. So we have the ability to be able to manage deductions. We have relationships with healthcare providers. So if you're a Web3 company, you sort of have to like pick, like, do you want to live in the crypto atmosphere or do you want to live in Web2? And this is one of these bridging things that we do. You know, we can help set you up with a full stack benefits that you know, you need to compete with to attract talent against other sort of like vanilla tech companies. So that's one, this sort of deductions management situation. We also have just some sort of like more streamlined payments tech. So if you are a controller at an organization, chances are you're drowning in invoices and receipts in your inbox, right? We've streamlined this process. Your workers can upload expense reimbursements. They can upload their invoices. And then it's pretty simple. You can just go in, review, release. You can schedule, deny, right? Add a policy.
Wow. Are you doing kind of expense reporting type stuff?
Yeah, definitely. So anything that you would have in Augusto, JustWorks, Rippling, Franklin has it too, and it has it in crypto. And then we'll push everything into your general ledger software, whether you're QuickBooks, you're using a crypto solution, like we got you covered there.
FTX was using QuickBooks.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think that they ever actually used it, right? It sounds like they didn't have an accounting department, so...
No, I'm just teasing.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's fascinating. So what about something like Bill.com? It feels like that's a whole nother ball of wax too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you start up a Web2 company, you sign up for Carta, you sign up for Bill.com, you've got Gusto, you've got DocuSign, right? All these things. There's some Twitter joke that, like, you know, VCs will fund a seed stage startup for 12 months of all these SaaS subscriptions, you know, which I think is hilarious.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's couple grand, right? Out of the box. You don't even need to think about it. It's what you need, right? Web3 doesn't need this, you know? Like, you don't have to have 100 different pieces of software to operate your business. You can have one, you know? And so that's kind of the thesis behind Franklin. And further than that, you don't have to, like, you know, payroll for a lot of companies is a huge capital expenditure, especially if you're using a PEO. Like, you can be doing things like making money off of your payroll, right? So that it moves off of, like, the expense line item and into like an asset category, right? Like, that's a little bit of, like, the longer term vision that we have. And I think it's part of the ethos of Web3 and, like, Web3 business models. You know, you don't need
Is that through clever things like treasury management?
Yeah,
utility,
definitely.
This kind of, oh, that's
yeah.
So cool.
It's cool.
That's,
you know,
really amazing.
A lot of payroll companies will hold, and some crypto companies do this too, which is just, you know, don't understand why, but they'll hold your cash for up to 10 business days. And they're the ones making money off of that float, right? It's strategic. Part of it is also because of how long it takes for cash to settle, right? ACH could take 5 days, right? Sometimes longer, depending on your bank. And so with crypto, we don't have those issues, right? And, you know, for us on the cash side, we're settling in 2 business days. So we're trying to be a little bit better on the margin, you know, on the Web2 side. Yeah.
Wow, that's quite impressive and exciting, right? Because I think what you're describing from a more roadmapping perspective is absolutely kind of tied to the broader thesis that we were looking at initially, right? Which is that we do think that, you know, at some point this gets close to, like, ERP, right? So, you know, when I described kind of payroll as enterprise application, right? Like, that word actually has a very specific and kind of ancient resonance, right? Which is, it really does have to do with, you know, accounting, right? It has to do with kind of, like, managing potentially very epically large organizations successfully, right? And obviously that involves all of the nooks and crannies of compliance and all the nooks and crannies of different kinds of, like, much more complex use cases. So, you know, I think it's very exciting that you're already delivering on these adjacencies. I'm sure the customer pain is there, you know, and I'm sure that you're bringing relief to your customers. So, you know, I guess in terms of sort of the future vision, right? Like, it sounds like you're pointing at a vision where, you know, the CFO perspective is one where you're really kind of consulting with one sort of, like, mechanism that's Franklin, right? That Franklin will kind of ultimately be able to deliver kind of a broad range of operational utility.
Yeah. And I think, you know, similar to how some of us are seeing our jobs transform with AI, you know, where you're more of a code editor using Copilot than you are maybe like a developer, we can do the same thing for a lot of these finance operational things, where because we have smart contracts, because we have unstoppable code, right, we can get to a place where you're doing a lot less button pushing and you're just doing a lot more monitoring. And I think that that's our sort of goal, is to, you know, free up CFOs and controllers to get out of the day-to-day of, I need to send a wire here or whatever there, I need to reconcile my payroll reports, to be where they can be thinking a little bit more strategically about the business, and have this sort of security that the money is going where it needs to go, and it's being done in a compliant manner, and it's sort of unquestionable. So that's where we're at.
You know what I love is that, you know, to me, the thing that I think becomes so fascinating is that when you think about interfaces and controls over systems, right, a lot of the controls and user interfaces that I think will go away are ones that I call fiddly interfaces, right? So, for example, something like travel planning, right, where you're kind of sitting around being like, oh, no, I want a direct flight. No, I want to leave in the morning. No, I want, you know, so you're just fiddling, right? You're constantly like Kayak or this kind of Expedia, these kind of interfaces, we're just fiddling. And it's kind of like, the thing that's amazing is when you think about it more like a policy perspective, right? Then the CFO can start instantiating policy and controlling policy and really letting, because one of the biggest pains in CFOs for startups is really things like the board packet, right? The monthly board packet, like the number of hours that goes into just dredging up and building these charts in Excel. And it's just like, it's just, it's so consuming of time. And like the thing that becomes genius is almost like this like natural language to SQL to visualization interfaces where board members can just ask questions and get answers like on the fly, right? Like, yeah. So to me, that makes the CFO's life like 1,000 times more strategic and 1,000 times less kind of like grindy and like,
yeah, I mean, that totally resonates with me because I was that person building a board deck, like rushing, let me close the financials, let me put it into a graph.
Oh,
like,
my
you
God.
Know, and this is also a good little like primer for the talk I'm going to give at ECC about this very topic. Like, how do you manage finance for an organization a little bit differently and more strategically using Web3? So thanks for that little amuse-bouche plug for Paris.
I love it. If you're at ECC, definitely don't miss this talk. I think it's, you know, obviously this goes far beyond, you know, just payroll. This is the future of finance. This is the future of CFOs. This definitely involves kind of like AI, and it involves kind of this transformation of a function from a kind of more like a cost center tactical function, you know, into like a fundamental strategic function. So that's super exciting to hear.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me, Miko. It's been so fun chatting with you.
Yeah, this wonderful show. And where should people follow you or the company?
Yeah, so check us out on Twitter at Franklin Payroll. And then our website also is hellofranklin.co.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.